Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney polling even in Florida and more primaries in southern states to come, we'll begin with an analysis of Newt Gingrich's southern strategy with Drew Weston, a political psychologist and neuroscientist and professor of psychology and psychiatry at Emory University. We will discuss what political antidotes might or could be used against ignorant, racist Republican voters who believe Obama is a Muslim with a fake birth certificate. Then Robert Young Pelton joins us. He is the founder and publisher of thesomaliareport.com, and we will discuss the rescue operation in Somalia that freed an American aid worker and a Danish worker with a demining unit. We will examine the changing tactics of piracy in this lawless, failed state as pirates move their activities onshore because of increased naval activity against them. Then finally, we'll speak with Ian Kim, the campaign manager of Rebuild the Dream, which, along with MoveOn.org and other progressive organizations, recently sent a letter to President Obama urging him to act and provide mortgage relief for more than 10 million American homeowners underwater, as well as pursue criminal charges against those who committed the massive fraud that led to the crash in 2008. We will discuss the president's announcements in last night's State of the Union of a financial crimes unit. Joining us now is Drew Weston, a clinical personality and political psychologist and neuroscientist and professor in the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at Emory University. He formerly taught at the University of Michigan, Harvard Medical School, and Boston University. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Drew Weston.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be back on.
And give us a sense then, since you're in Atlanta, I don't know whether Newt Gingrich used to be your congressman, but he was, I think, wasn't he the congressman from Mount Marietta there in suburban Georgia?
He was quite near me. Fortunately, it's kind of like a bad case of the plague. You hope it's a couple counties over, which he was.
So give us a sense of his southern strategy, because he's clearly doing a lot of sort of race baiting. And in the acceptance in South Carolina, he castigated and lectured the press saying, and the establishment saying, that they don't get it, they don't understand, that it's not my debating skills, as the press report, but I connect with the real people about real issues. And he also infers, and he said, and not inferred, he's quite clear, that the last 30 years the country has been sort of captured by some liberal elite that's taking it in an un-American direction. What's he talking about?
Well, it depends on which universe you're in. You know, if you're in the universe of the voters who he is trying to appeal to, he's saying all the right things. You know, there's this liberal elite that's put these activist judges like Alito and Roberts, who are passing all this activist, who are making all these activist liberal judicial rulings, and there's a liberal elite that controls the media like Rupert Murdoch. And there's always been this, historian Doug Hofstadter called it the paranoid style in American politics. And he's really appealing to the Oklahoma City bombers of the world. But then there's this other piece, which you're referring to, the Southern strategy, he's about as unsubtle about it as we've seen in a lot of years. Started by Richard Nixon with the able-bodied welfare loafers, which, you know, everybody pictured black people, and then continued with Ronald Reagan with his welfare queens. Haley Barbour's been pretty unsubtle with his descriptions of Mississippi people on Medicaid who, you know, drive up in their BMWs to pharmacies and claim they don't have the money for a copay. And then you got Newt Gingrich talking about Barack Obama's a food stamp president. You don't get, I guess the last comment on that would be that I've been struck by the questions raised by the quote unquote liberal media about this, who have been asking the question, is this race baiting? It's kind of like asking, is grass green? if that isn't race baiting, I can't imagine what would be.
So how is it going to play, though, this strategy in a more diverse state, Florida? Of course, the north, the panhandle, is really the south. But the south of Florida is fairly pluralistic. You've got a big Jewish vote. Of course, most of that's Democratic. You've got the Miami Cubans who tend to vote Republican, and then the corridor down the middle. What's your sense of where he's going to tailor this message that was so successful in South Carolina? Because throughout Super Tuesday, it's a lot of the southern states where I'm sure it's going to play well.
Yeah, you know, he's doing one thing, I think, that one thing wrong and a couple things right in this neck of the woods. I think the thing that he's doing, I mean, putting aside the ethics of all this, which is, you know, I think race baiting is about as low as you get, and history will look back at people like him the same way they looked at Richard Nixon for it. And it, you know, it's a pretty despicable practice, but it's you know, clearly very successful among the people who fly the Confederate flag in their you know, on their state capital in South Carolina. But the part of it that is likely to be successful is that you're absolutely right that northern Florida is really an extension of Georgia. Of South Georgia, and you're looking at people who you know, come from families that have been around here since the Civil War. I live in Georgia, and this is going to play quite well with them, and I think he's going to win a lot of those voters with this kind of you know, dog whistle race baiting stuff. He does have to worry that the race baiting Latino voters will hear the race baiting and get concerned about it, because they know that they're the next race over. You know, when you go after black people that way, he's made a couple of comments about brown people that way too, about Spanish being the language of the ghetto, which he had to explain himself on. And so it's not hard to figure out what's in the heart of someone who can call Barack Obama the food stamp president. You know, what's working for him is the fact that two things. One is that that Mitt Romney has tried to be the better racist on immigration, you know, by telling young people whose parents came here without papers, who themselves didn't do anything wrong, to go back to Mexico where they belong when they've never stepped on Mexican soil.
Yeah, self-deportation, I think he called it.
Yes, self-deportation was a great one too. He's really blowing himself up with the Latino population. But the other thing that Newt's doing right is he's using right-wing populism in the way that the Tea Partiers did a couple of years ago. And it's really resonant because people are really angry at corporations, and the left, as represented in people's minds by the Democratic Party, which is, you know, these days in complete shambles, has been really hasn't used populist language very much at all, and has left it to the right to use. The president tried to summon his inner populist last night. And in Kansas, but other than that, we haven't seen much of it. So you know, Newt's getting at that kind of angry right wing populism, and that's gonna help him out.
Particularly, I think, with the so-called Reagan Democrats, right? As well as the Dixiecrats.
No, I think that's right, and you know, they're angry for many reasons, but you know, the biggest one being that they've perceived correctly that they're getting the shaft, and unfortunately, Democrats haven't figured out a way to talk with them about it, because this should be a natural issue for progressives, is the issue of a government of, by, and for big corporations instead of by, and for the people. That should naturally be a position from the left, and instead it's been taken over by the right. And Gingrich has been very opportunistic in picking it up, even though, you know, he's one of the biggest offenders.
Again, I'm speaking with Drew Weston, a clinical personality and political psychologist and neuroscientist and professor in the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at Emory University. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. And we're talking about the extent to which the fate of the nation might be decided by either Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney, who seem to be tearing each other apart. At the very least, one has to assume that if they make it to the Republican convention in Tampa, they'll both be damaged goods. So when you say the Democrats are in disarray, I think you have to also say the Republicans are in disarray too, aren't they?
They are. I mean, the disarray of the Democrats, I think, is just that they no longer represent the party of the middle class and of working people. And you know, despite their protestations, they haven't done very much for working people in the last few years. When you know, there's been a lot of rhetoric, but the actions haven't followed. The foreclosures have been fast and furious, while the trillions of dollars from the Fed at zero interest has been going to the banks that have been foreclosing on them. That's not normally what Democrats are supposed to do. But you know, I think Obama is the luckiest man in the world. You and I were having a conversation about this before the show. That you know, he got to run against a doddering old John McCain who twisted himself in a pretzel to win over the right wing lunatic fringe in 2008, and he's going to get to either run against a Newt Gingrich who has carries with him much more baggage than will fit in the overhead compartment, and the flight attendants are gonna be pulling that stuff out. Or he's going to be running against Mitt Romney and his 15% taxes and his Cayman Island tax shelters and his absolutely deaf ear for the pain of the average American who can't get that 15% tax break on his $10 or $15 million a year.
Well, Drew Weston, you wrote a piece in the New York Times that certainly got the White House upset about what went wrong in the first few years there in terms of how they missed the big one, which was how come the Tea Party ran away with the outrage on Wall Street while the White House and the left, you know, left that one on the table. And, you know, it's worth noting that for all of Mitt Romney's privileges in terms of tax rates of 13.9%, on $23 million in 1 year, and he won't release the earlier years, which I think are probably really some much, much more smoking guns in there, because a lot of that carried interest is at the behest of Senator Chuck Schumer, isn't it?
Well, that is kind of a sad thing about our one-party system right now.
Right. But how does the president conduct a campaign against this venality, this vitriol, this hatred? I think in many ways the subtext for much of what's being said about him by both Gingrich and Santorum, and you know, Santorum did not correct that woman recently who said that, you know, he's a Muslim and an imposter, and he sort of smiled in his beatifical way. So this seems to be out there in the electorate, this rampant ignorance. What's the political antidote to racist ignorance?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and the lucky thing for the president, I think, is again that both of these guys are so flawed that whichever one runs against him will probably lose simply because he'll either come off as so out of touch, or Gingrich will have some kind of psychiatric episode and or declare himself the Messiah or something like that, that just completely turns the electorate off. But I think he's probably gonna survive those racist attacks. But you know, in general, the best strategy is the one that we learned about about as clearly as you can get in 2008 when the Reverend Wright catastrophe was visiting itself on the Obama campaign and you know, white people were seeing that endless loop of Reverend Wright attacking America and saying, you know, God damn America and all that kind of stuff, and this was Obama's preacher, And he gave a brilliant talk, a speech on race, in which he spoke openly about the issues. And speaking openly about race is actually the best way to deal with these kind of subterranean attacks. And the reason for that is actually there's a very good psychological reason for it, which is that our better angels on race tend to be our conscious values. That the average American, the average white American, does not wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say, "I'm a racist and I'm proud." Most of us don't want to be racist. We don't want to be prejudiced. We think of ourselves as good and decent people who don't judge people on the basis of their color. So if you speak directly to those values and get them out on the table, then people respond really well to it. If, on the other hand, you let this stuff stay subterranean and you let people make those dog whistles of the food stamp president, and you let it fester unconsciously, that's where the greatest prejudice is today. It's either unconscious or barely conscious. And the last thing the president should want to do is to let people, the Gingrich voters or the independents who could hear him sounding smart, because he can sound quite smart when he's not saying something really stupid. That when he's sounding smart, when they hear something like that, they could turn their resentment against freeloaders instead of against the freeloading corporations. They could turn it towards people who are poor and who they automatically picture as black, which by the way is just one of the other fallacies behind what Gingrich is saying, is that the average person on food stamps right now actually happens to be white because George W. Bush put so many white people out of a job, particularly white males. So if Barack Obama is the food stamp president, he is the president who has presided over the greatest number of white people on food stamps.
Well, Drew Weston, I thank you so much for joining us here, and we should stay in touch, because this race is going to get nastier, not to mention longer.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be on, and I can't believe, Ian, that you would call it a race. That's one of those dog whistle things. No, I'm just teasing.
Bye for now.
Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Drew Weston, a clinical personality and political psychologist and neuroscientist and professor in the departments of psychology and psychiatry at Emory University. He formerly taught at the University of Michigan, Harvard Medical School, and Boston University, and is the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the rescue operation in Somalia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He has a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And what is the inside scoop then on what just happened in Somalia just before the President's State of the Union address, apparently? he was informed that a Danish and American hostage were rescued by the same SEAL Team 6 that killed Osama bin Laden. What do you know about what happened?
Two things. One is there's no such thing as SEAL Team 6. It's called DEVGRU, and it's actually a unit called the Joint Special Operations Command Horn of Africa, or CJTF HOA, which is based in Camp Lemanye. And it's made out of Air Force, Marine, foreign elements, Navy SEALs, and a variety of special operations folks. But they like to promote that myth of SEAL Team 6 being everywhere. The second thing is you just saw for the first time since 1993 the overt presence of American boots on the ground. And if you remember Black Hawk Down and the controversy surrounding that incident, we've always had this sort of unwritten rule that you can't put American boots on the ground. So you just saw a very public view that, yes, we can, and we can get away with it. So you'll see a change, I think, in more operations, because there's another America that was kidnapped 3 days ago, and over 150 foreigners in the maritime and other kidnap victims. So things will change.
So just to touch on the American journalist who was kidnapped on Friday, who is this journalist? Do you know?
Yeah, well, Michael Scott Moore is actually from Manhattan Beach, California. He lives in Berlin now. He writes for Der Spiegel, and he also writes for The Atlantic, although Der Spiegel is trying to shut down coverage of his kidnap. He was over there doing a story, a book about pirates, and following up on an interview he had done and published in Der Spiegel about building a new port in Habio, which is a pirate center. He went out to meet someone at the airport and was kidnapped by two men in two SUVs, Toyota Surfs, and then taken down to Habio, where the elders argued with his kidnappers, and then moved out of town, and he's now being held.
So the people that were just rescued, an American aid worker, Jessica Buchanan, and a Danish D-miner, Paul Thisted, they were captured back in October. Weren't they captured also by, or wasn't there some complicity with their driver?
Exact same road, exact same techniques. What happened is that these two folks work for Danish Refugee Council. They were doing a seminar on UXO and demining. They went into town. They were on their way home. They were actually stopped on the way to the airport and essentially kidnapped by their own guard. That guard were arrested, and then they magically disappeared out of jail. They've been moved around. They've been put on ships. They've been moved here and there by elders who are very angry at the pirates holding them. But the good thing is that pirates have just recently started moving towards land-based kidnapping, and they're not that smart about using cell phones. They're not that smart about what predators can do. So the Americans have a lot of assets in the region in the air, so they were able to track the pirates' movements, get a visual on the two victims, and then launch this raid.
So you're suggesting that because I take it a beefed-up naval presence in the waters around Somalia, that the pirates are moving to land-based kidnapping as opposed to capturing ships?
Right. Well, this is the kidnapping 101. Since about 2005, the pirates have been complicit with insurance companies where if they know that they can grab a ship and not damage the cargo or the crew, they know that they'll be able to negotiate a fairly sizable ransom. Those ransoms run about $4.5 million on average. But the unwritten rule is you can't damage the cargo or the ship. You can't harm the hostages. Well, what happened is that these maritime companies began putting private security guards, which Hillary Clinton actually promoted, on these ships, which has stopped and reduced the number of hijackings to almost less than one a month. So now these pirates are desperate for cash, and then they decided to go after the NGOs and the journalists and the few foreigners that are in town. They even bought two Spanish MSF workers from Al-Shabaab for $250,000, and they want to turn that into a profit. But here's the problem, that when they used to hold 20 to 30 crew on a ship, nobody ever came after them because they knew that typically a UK-based insurance company would pay them money, so there was no rescue attempts. Now you've got people that don't have insurance. There is no sort of standard procedure. And you've got governments that are sort of sick and tired of this constant criminality and they're literally, you know, 15 minutes away. So that's why the pirates are learning the hard way that land-based kidnapping is not a good idea.
And the MSF, that's the Médecins Sans Frontières, who are they holding there?
There were two Spanish ladies that were working.
They're doctors, right?
Correct. They were working in Dadaab refugee camp, which is right on the border of Kenya and Somalia in the south. And Al-Shabaab had created a plan to destroy tourism in Kenya and also to disrupt aid and relief workers. And they began to put this plan into play, but what happened was that one of their leaders got killed and they got scared. So they managed to kidnap Judith Tebbit. They shot her husband. She was on vacation at a coastal resort near Lamu. They kidnapped this poor elderly French woman who was in a wheelchair. Unfortunately, she died while in captivity. They grabbed these two MSF gals, and they had sort of an open order for any foreigners. They ended up flipping these victims to a pirate called Afweni, who works out of Hardir in the central part of Somalia. So right now, in addition to the maritime people, which is over 100 sailors, you've also got about 20 land-based hostages, mostly around the central part of what they call Galmudug, the central part of Somalia.
Again, I'm speaking of Robert Young Pelton, who is the founder and publisher of Somalia Report. We're talking about the rescue of the American and the Danish hostages by a U.S. Special Forces team and the broader issue of piracy. Now, in Somalia, which of course is a totally failed state with an African Union force in the north and chaos in the south, where Al-Shabaab, the allegedly Al-Qaeda-related organization, operates. In this case, it's criminality and not Al-Shabaab, which has some political veneer to it.
Correct.
But you just told me that the Al-Shabaab grabbed a couple of hostages, Western hostages, and then sold them to a pirate?
Yeah, they needed the money. This was not something they planned, and Al-Shabaab does not communicate or typically do business with pirates, because pirates know that would then unleash all the anti-terrorism forces on them. And Al-Shabaab does not get involved in piracy because they think it's a criminal act. So what happened was you had one group of Al-Shabaab who needed the cash because they were being attacked by the Kenyans and they were under pressure. So they made a quick payment, about $450,000, by selling the two MSF gals to a pirate.
But who's still holding them, right?
Yes, they're still being kidnapped. The interesting thing is that there's only two countries that have assets in the region, and that's the French and the Americans, and they both operate out of Camp Lamanye. This is in Djibouti, yes. It's a little tiny country in the straits there. And that's about it. So even the naval forces really can't deal with pirates. If you remember, four Americans were killed when the USS Enterprise and the Stennis got involved in trying to prevent a hijacking, and it freaked the pirates out, and they ended up killing their hostages before the special operations team got there.
So this base that they have, Camp Lamanye in Djibouti, this tiny little country in the Gulf there of Aden, I guess it's called.
Mm-hmm.
What, it has about 2,500 permanent Marines based there, and they have
they have an overt and covert capability there. So they have an overt stationing of aviation support and Marines, and they've got a covert collection of anti-terrorism people. And just by coincidence, one of the Special Forces guys I was with worked out of there. And it's a wide mix of special operations people from various countries, and they get together and they go out, typically in Yemen. Their task was really going after Al-Qaeda in Yemen and also northern Kenya. So they use that as a base to launch deep strikes. And so they'd be between Nairobi, a tiny base up in Lamu, and then some just very minor support on the ground in Somalia. They can kind of reach out, do predator strikes, do snatch and grabs, things like that.
But you mentioned earlier, Robert Young Pelton, that the same team that killed bin Laden, that apparently rescued this American aid worker, Jessica Buchanan, and the Danish D-miner, that they were picked up by a predator drone. So I take it that predator drones also operate out of this area, right?
The drones operate out of Ethiopia along the border there. There's a program there. You get a cluster of three drones to keep them up in the air for 24 hours. There's also a grouping in the Seychelles, and then they also have a drone program in Camp Lamagne. So they're basically in the south, though. They're really looking for Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab-related targets. In the north, they're not worried about piracy so much, but they do track some of the movements because Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have been sailing north from the south into the northern part of Somalia and back into Yemen because there's a safe haven for them on the coast of Yemen. So they cover that region, but there aren't that many people.
So what's happening with this surrogate war or this quiet war that's going on against Al-Shabaab, where the U.S. is essentially paying the Kenyans and the Ugandans, aren't they, to do the boots on the ground?
Well, the U.N. force is called AMISOM. They started off in Mogadishu, and it was primarily Ugandans in very entrenched positions, but they've had some success. So the Kenyans did a little fast trick. They actually invaded and then convinced the U.S. to actually pay them to invade, so they became part of AMISOM. Ethiopia has the top border under control, but they don't want to be part of AMISOM, if you remember what happened in 2006 and 2007.
Well, that was when George Bush sent the Ethiopians in, right?
Yeah, and that's when they created Al-Shabaab, because the people rebelled against the Christian Ethiopians.
That was a minor blunder, but apropos, or in the spirit of, if you will, Iraq, right?
Yeah, that, you know, you can win and lose at the same time. So they won by kicking out the Islamic courts, but they ended up creating a much different problem, which was cementing Al-Qaeda with this group called Al-Shabaab, which is who is fighting in Kenya and also Somalia. So that war has been spread by the Kenyans going in to Somalia. There are now terrorist threats inside Kenya, and actually a new Al-Qaeda leader who has threatened to start a war inside Kenya. So once again, you can win militarily, but you can lose on the security angle.
So you mentioned earlier, Robert Young Pelton, again, the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, that this raid that just took place just as the State of the Union began, you know, the president apparently signaled to the Secretary of Defense as he was being applauded in the Congress, you know, good job. Mm-hmm. So I guess they were just getting the word right at that moment.
Well, there's a political slant to it, because we've been following these people from the day they were kidnapped, and we know their location and who's holding them, and we talk to their kidnappers. So it's rather unusual that President Obama would just happen to greenlight this raid on the same day he was doing a State of the Union speech, and also try to tie it into the same group, SEAL Team 6. So there's no proof that SEAL Team 6 was involved in this, because there's no such group as SEAL Team 6. They work with the folks in Lamagne, but you can see a little Hollywood script forming here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of, he bookended his State of the Union with praise of the military. So tell me, though, when you said that after there's been this aversion to getting boots on the ground in Somalia since Black Hawk Down, which happened under Clinton, who inherited the
Bush's
intervention,
right,
which was a humanitarian intervention that turned into a military intervention. What evidence is there that there's a sea change here, that now the U.S. is more prepared to put boots on the ground in this totally failed state?
Well, what happened was that they were doing a hands-off approach, and you had actually Libya funding most of the Somali government activities. It was based on, you know, if you show us some results, we'll give you some money. So what happened is Uganda got very aggressive. They had 12,000 people there. They actually were able to push Al-Shabaab out. Kenya saw the opportunity. They had planned this thing with the U.S. for over 2 years, and the U.S. wasn't that thrilled about the idea of Kenya invading, because they've never actually fought a war before, and they only have 5 jets. And Ethiopia had been warned against interceding. And essentially what happened is that these local actors said, look, we're not going to tolerate this anymore, you know, incursions, kidnappings, terrorism. So Kenya made its move. The U.S. tacitly approved it, even though they said publicly they had no idea that Kenya was invading Somalia. Ethiopia magically charged all the way into the northern part, and suddenly money's flowing, and they're increasing the size of the peacekeeping force and even changing their mission. And Al-Shabaab is on the run. Al-Shabaab is being damaged by the larger military presence inside Somalia. So it's actually all good news when you compare it to the old way things were. But, you know, it's another Libya. We are essentially, you know, bankrolling someone to go in and start a war and try to keep our fingerprints off it.
Well, it also sounds like a kind of sovereign version of Halliburton, isn't it, where you actually hire the armies of sovereign countries?
Well, we learned our lesson. So, yes, there are some contractors working inside Somalia, which I do an in-depth review on the site, but it's easier to pay poor African countries because we only pay about $1,200 per month per troop. The government pockets about half of that, so Uganda, Kenya, I think Djibouti's got some troops in there, and they're going to send some troops from Sierra Leone, and, you know, it's sort of a pylon. That money goes into the government's pockets. They get new guns, they get new uniforms, they get all kinds of goodies. And we're essentially providing this sort of military aid through the back door. The training is all done by U.S. Special Forces back in their home territory. So it's a proxy war, but through sovereign states.
And it's a lot cheaper than hiring Eric Prince at Blackwater, right? Or
well, it's a lot cheaper than the political risk involved of having American troops there. There are contractors working there, and they do have money. You know, the CIA pays contractors to train up local troops inside the country. But I think, you know, under the Obama administration, they're very concerned about political risk. They don't want to see another Fallujah or Black Hawk Down where Americans are chopped up and hanging from light poles. So I think they've made that decision that there will be no Americans visually on the ground. And that's why you see these proxy forces.
Well, just in closing, what's the latest on the ex-CIA guy that's running Puntland along with the former UN human rights guy, Pierre Prosper? Have they managed to sort of carve out a little kind of peaceful island there in the middle of this war-torn country?
Yeah, Somaliland is probably the most peaceful region, and they broke away back in the 90s. And then Puntland didn't break away entirely. But their major trading partner is the UAE, and the UAE paid for a very large anti-piracy training program, and that's actually happening right now as we speak. I think there were a number of people linked into it because they thought it was a good idea, and the State Department and other people in Nairobi said, well, we don't think that's a good idea. So there was a lot of bad publicity, but I've actually been up there and seen the camp and seen the recruits. It's the only indigenous anti-piracy activity going on in Somalia. So it's showing that everybody is basically tired of waiting around for Uncle Sam to write them a check direct, and they've done these things on their own, and all of a sudden the money flows behind it. So Puntland is doing well, although a lot of Al-Shabaab are moving up into Puntland, and the same with Somaliland. But these nations seem to do better on their own than without us babysitting them and steering them.
But, you know, pirates don't sort of, you know, watch a Johnny Depp movie and decide overnight to become a pirate. Aren't they pirates out of desperation? They've lost their fishing grounds. They have no money.
No, that's a myth. It's a very funny myth, because I spent a lot of time talking to pirates and visiting with them. What happened was in 2000, a security company named Hart trained up a maritime defense force and taught the same guys who fought in Black Hawk Down, the Habagadir, how to board a ship, how to look at the manifest, how to call the owner, how to fine, you know, take the ship under control, take it back to port, and collect the fine. That project fell apart in 2000, sort of late 2000, and this same Marine force and the same sort of anti-piracy force said, hey, you know, instead of making $50 a month, why don't we just grab ships on our own? That was the nucleus of the modern pirates we see today, because they knew about the insurance payments and not harming the crew or the cargo to get paid. But those guys, the big three, have all been retired or put in jail. So the new crew are the ones that are doing the land-based hijacking, and their lifespans are going to be fairly short. So it evolves every month.
But did you say that we trained up these people to become pirates?
Well, I don't say we. Not you and me. I mean, Hart is a British company.
What was their motive?
Well, it was a very good motive. It was to restart the fishing industry, because the tuna that go by the coast of Somalia can reach, you know, between $5,000 and $10,000 if they're frozen and shipped off to Japan. Right now you can buy an entire tuna for $2, bluefin tuna. So their idea was to stop the poachers, you know, the large fishing fleets that go in there and steal all the fish from Spain and China.
Taiwan, right?
Exactly, and kick them out and then keep that money inside the country. But the country fell apart, so...
Oh, I see.
So those people who had jobs suddenly didn't have jobs, and thought Coast Guarding was akin to piracy. So that's how it started.
Well, I thank you so much for filling us in on this country that is in the news, but not in the, not in the way that you've explained. So I recommend people go to your site, SomaliaReport.com.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com. He has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about President Obama's new financial police force. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Kim, the campaign manager of Rebuild the Dream, which along with MoveOn.org and other progressive organizations and more than 360,000 Americans, recently wrote a letter to President Obama calling for mortgage relief for more than 10 million American homeowners underwater and for prosecution of those responsible for the massive fraud that caused the 2008 Wall Street crash. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Kim.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on the program.
And Ian, it looks like your letter got a response in the State of the Union. The president called for the creation of a financial crimes unit to investigate, quoting the president, the abusive lending and packaging of risky mortgages that led to the whole housing crisis. So are you pleased?
I am pleased. And, you know, I think this is a good example of the president and the administration listening to the base and paying attention to what people are really calling for and what people really need. I work at Rebuild the Dream. We're a new national organization fighting for a fair economy. I really want to emphasize that we worked alongside dozens of other groups, and, you know, we were part of a groundswell of hundreds of thousands of Americans who called for a big investigation into Wall Street and banking fraud when it comes to the mortgage crisis. So, it wasn't the president listening just to us. It was the president listening to a big groundswell and a movement that built up over the last several months calling for this kind of investigation. Frankly, it's somewhat shocking that this many years into the housing and financial crisis, there hasn't been an investigation, and we're really pleased to see that now we might have a shot at a strong investigation that can really uncover the truth.
And Ian Kim, this new group that the president has set up, this agency was a part of the Justice Department, largely U.S. attorneys there, the Financial Crimes Unit. It's going to be apparently headed up by New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and he, of course, he was forced out of a group of attorney generals negotiating a settlement with the big banks. He and the attorney general here in California, Kamala Harris, have felt that the global settlement that the White House was pushing was insufficient. So I'm trying to figure out here what's going on. On the one hand, he's going to be head of this new unit, but on the other hand, he and the attorney general of California don't want to make this deal with the banks, which they think is not sufficiently good for the consumer in terms of the robo signing and the fraud that went on after the 2008 crash.
Yeah, first of all, I do just want to agree with you that Eric Schneiderman, the New York State Attorney General, and Kamala Harris, our Attorney General here in California, have both proven themselves to be heroes in standing up against the big banks and defending these homeowners who have really just been who are drowning with these underwater mortgages. And I think it's important to just take a step back and take stock of the situation that we're in broadly. I have a Yale MBA. When I was in business school in the early 2000s, a finance professor, somebody who used to work at J.P. Morgan, this was shortly after the dot-com bust that we experienced so sharply here in California, he said, the only thing more predictable than the dot-com bust that just happened is the housing bust that's about to happen. He said that in 2002. So, the irrational exuberance of the mortgage market and then the way that these irresponsible mortgage lending practices got bundled up and bound into our entire global financial market really deserves some investigation. And the blame for that cannot be laid just at the feet of homeowners. There's too much really clear evidence that banks were not just tempting homeowners against their own good, but really fooling, tricking, defrauding, and breaking the law when it came to the way mortgages were originated and serviced and financed. So having said all that, now we're in the situation where if you take all the homeowners in the country and you underwater homeowners in the country, you add it up, there's at least $750 billion in negative equity across the country. And the big question is, how are we going to fix this problem? And it's really going to take a lot of courage and a lot of leadership to fix this problem and to come up with solutions at the scale of that problem. So that backstory brings us to this present day. For the last several months, state attorneys general from across the country have been negotiating with the big banks on a settlement, and where the idea is that the banks would help to pay down some of that negative equity, and in response, the banks may get some immunity for some of their activities. I have to say, the thing to point out is that how we got there in the first place with the settlement is that it was discovered that in states like Florida and Nevada and in California, these big banks were doing robo-signing, meaning that they were signing off on mortgages and without even having looked at the documents, just sort of electronically approving as part of a mortgage factory. And so then banks were taking ownership of properties and foreclosing on homeowners without any real evidence that they actually had the papers to show that they owned the property. So that's just one example of fraud. It's the most egregious one that people are aware of. That's the thing that has instigated the settlement. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more to be investigated, and we're happy that this investigation is happening.
Well, 60 Minutes did a very, very disturbing and revealing piece on it recently, where it was made very clear that the banks hired fraudsters to go out and manufacture and forge documents to justify their ownership.
That's right.
And if an ordinary civilian did that, they'd be locked away for years, right?
That's right. So, the thing that seems clear is that those practices and that fraud is just the tip of the iceberg, and that the banks hold a lot more responsibility for the crisis that so many people find themselves in, and that's holding down our economy. We're pleased that the president announced in his State of the Union address last night this financial crimes unit. We're pleased that New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is going to lead that financial crimes unit with, the backing of the Federal Department of Justice. And it's going to be very, very important for us to watch that investigation and to ensure that that investigation goes well and that it's not, that's not just smoke and mirrors. So this is a key thing to watch, and we do need some justice from the Department of Justice on this.
Again, I'm speaking with Ian Kim, the campaign manager of Rebuild the Dream, which along with MoveOn.org and other progressive organizations and more than 360,000 Americans recently wrote a letter to President Obama calling for mortgage relief for the more than 10 million American homeowners underwater and for prosecution of those responsible for the massive fraud that caused the 2008 Wall Street crash. And it looks as though the president has come through in terms of a financial crimes unit, but it's not clear at all whether this will differ from the Financial Fraud Enforcement Task Force, which is a cross-agency group that the President Obama established in November 2009. We don't know what kind of teeth this new agency is going to have. We know that it's in the Justice Department and be largely comprised of U.S. attorneys, right?
That's right. And you're raising a really good question, which is, you know, it's the right question, is how will this new investigation unit really have teeth? You know, it's clear that Eric Schneiderman has fire in his belly, but you know what we've learned in the last 24 hours is that he's not chairing this investigation unit by himself. He's co-chairing it with some other folks who may not have the same fire in their bellies. And what we need to ensure and push on is that Schneiderman, as the real hero here, has the full authority to conduct. A complete and thorough investigation without obstruction. And, you know, too often we've seen regulatory agencies that, you know, whose role is supposed to be regulating big companies, and, you know, and instead it looks more like, you know, they're sort of sweethearts with the big companies. And that kind of, like, lax oversight and sweetheart regulation is a big part of what led to the BP oil spill in the Gulf. And, you know, it's part of what has led to the financial crisis that we have here. So we really do need to make sure that this financial crimes unit and the president's speech last night are a turning point, that we're moving into a new era of a new phase of toughness by the Obama administration toward the big banks who really, really need to be held to account. They've got to pay up big time for what they're so much responsible for.
And just speaking about sweetheart deals, recently a U.S. federal district judge, Rakoff in Manhattan, rejected a proposed $285 million settlement in a case between the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Citigroup, a sweetheart deal that the judge himself rejected because he thought it was it wasn't in the public interest over a complex mortgage securities that were marketed by Citigroup back in 2007. So we know there's a lot to be done on the financial fraud side. What good news is there from the President's State of the Union announcements last night about the 10 to 11 million Americans who are underwater with their mortgages facing foreclosure? My understanding that he's sending legislation to Capitol Hill that would make it easy for homeowners to pay a lower interest on their mortgages, saving people up to $3,000 per year. Well, that's probably just one mortgage payment. I don't see that as solving this huge problem.
Yeah, it's not clear to me what relationship that idea has with the underwater mortgage problem. You know, I have a mortgage here in California for my home, and I'm, you know, blessed and fortunate that my mortgage is not underwater. I probably could and should refinance to a lower interest rate, and it sounded to me like what President Obama was proposing was a way to make it easier for homeowners like me, who haven't fallen behind and haven't had trouble with the underwater problem, to refinance just to lower our payments. That sounds good. But it's not clear to me how much that helps the 10 or 11 million underwater homeowners who have had problems, who haven't necessarily been able to keep up with their payments, whose interest rates on their mortgages have skyrocketed because, you know, their adjustable rate mortgages, you know, ballooned well beyond the point when banks had promised to refinance. You know, there's a way that homeowners in this situation have gotten caught in the bind, and they can't rightly make the claim that they've kept up with all their payments. And in fact, oftentimes homeowners get the advice to stop making payments to get the bank's attention. So then, what do we do there? Mm-hmm. I've got a good friend. His name is Michael here in San Francisco. He purchased a home here. Bought into his American dream, right, at the height of the boom, was promised by Bank of America that he could refinance after 5 years for his adjustable rate mortgage. That 5 years was up. His property was down. It went way underwater. And
I'm sorry to tell you that we're pretty much out of time here. I thank you so much, Ian Kim, again, for joining us here, and we'll stay in touch, I hope.
Great. Thank you for the interview. It's good to talk to you.
Again, I'm speaking with Ian King, the campaign manager for Rebuild the Dream, about the letter they sent to President Obama, which appears to have had an effect. The president is announcing his, in the State of the Union, creation of the Financial Crimes Unit. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Drew Weston, a political psychologist and neuroscientist and professor of psychology and psychiatry at Emory University down in Atlanta there, Newt Gingrich's hometown. I asked him about Newt's Southern strategy and how that's going to work out for him since it was so successful in South Carolina. It seems to be working in Florida, and he's got all the big Southern states in the Super Tuesday vote coming up. He seemed to think that the whole thing was a flashback to the 50s, and it's appalling that this is the kind of dialogue that's out there, this race-baiting code that he's using. But it's clearly working, and it'll clearly work with the Dixiecrats, but he also thought it would work with the angry white blue-collar voters, the so-called Reagan Democrats. And he basically, though, said that, Obama's the luckiest guy in the world because he's got these two idiots tearing each other apart, Gingrich and Romney. So whoever survives is going to be completely damaged. And, you know, he got lucky last time running against what he called a doddering old fool, McCain. Then I talked with Robert Young Pelton, the founder and publisher of the SomaliaReport.com, which is truly the best source on anything that's happening in Somalia. Not that anybody's particularly interested in that war-torn, failed state, but there was a raid supposedly with the same guys that killed bin Laden, that rescued an American aid worker and a Danish D-miner. Pelton pretty much refuted that it was the same unit, and it says that's not called SEAL Team 6 in any case. All the action apparently is in Djibouti, which is a small former French colony where the U.S. has a base, flying drones, etc. But he basically said that the pirates have come ashore and are grabbing people on the land simply because the naval presence there has been so great that they've driven them ashore. He also said, curious enough, it was the British who trained these original pirates and taught them how to board ships in taking care of their depleted fishing fields. So there's an irony there. And then finally, I spoke with Ian Kim, the campaign manager of Rebuild the Dream, who, along with MoveOn.org and other progressive organizations with 360,000 American signatures, wrote a letter to President Obama recently calling for mortgage relief for more than more than 10 million people, American homeowners, underwater, and calling for the prosecution of those responsible for the massing fraud that brought about the Wall Street crash. And he feels that at least the president was listening in this regard and thought that maybe there would be something done about prosecutions, but was a little skeptical about what may be done in terms of mortgage release. And obviously, we're going to have to look deeper into the details of that. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.